Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I would not put it past Corey to blow me up on live TV just for the ratings.
Yeah, but then what would we do for Sweeps Week, you know?
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. Today, we are doing a special one-off episode about the Apple TV Plus series, The Morning Show.
I had to actually cut together my own obit package. Literally, your whole life cut down to 90 seconds to a Beach Boys cover.
They won't pay for an original Beach Boys song?
No. Budget cuts.
We are in the third season of the Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon fronted show, and we've got an interview with two producers who have been there since the beginning. We'll be covering what happened in the first four episodes.
But in case you can't remember, here's a quick refresher of what's happened so far. We started the season with Corey, the CEO of UBA, trying to sell the network to tech billionaire Paul Marks, and to send Alex to space in the process. Last minute, Bradley subs in for Alex, but hey, space.
After 2 years of a pandemic and now a war in Ukraine, it's incredible to look down and see how connected we all are.
It's so tragic.
A cyber attack puts every email, text, and piece of confidential information about the network out in the open, and Paul Marks pulls out.
If they have medical records or subscriber data, we have to call the FBI. Then you're looking at employee lawsuits, class action.
You know, every time that you start to speak, things feel like they're getting worse. That's a special gift.
Bradley worries her relationship with Laura is exposed. Meanwhile, a racist email from Sybil to the board puts her under the bright lights of the morning show.
You used a clumsy racist comment to complain about my hiring. Did you think I wasn't qualified? Was that it?
Well, now, in point of fact, at that time, I did not believe you were qualified.
And at Upfronts, UBA is tap dancing for advertisers and money to save the network. It's looking pretty grim until Alex turns up with billionaire Paul Marks.
Fucking believable. Alex Levy brought home the kill.
So, Richard, you are a morning show fan.
Well, yes, I am.
Richard, you are watching the morning show.
Stand in your truth.
I find it a really interesting show, and as our interview will enlighten, there's a lot of... There's so many moving parts of the show, and it's engaging like a sort of workplace Sorkin-esque show, you know, tends to be. This season, I think, has really ratcheted up things. You know, as I mentioned in the synopsis, Reese Witherspoon does go to space.
I hope that was actually filmed in space.
Yeah. Oh, no, of course. It's Apple.
They got the money.
Yeah, yeah.
They probably have the ship.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's kind of one of those shows because they do a lot of recent news. It's kind of like the newsroom.
Is it like
did.
The newsroom? Okay.
But it's less heavy-handed about that.
Okay.
And so I'm always...
That is perhaps faint praise.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just ever curious to see, okay, like, what are they going to bring in now? Like, I think the last season ended with someone coughing.
Oh, so that's COVID. Yeah. I did hear that there was a COVID.
Yeah, there was
COVID. And then Trump is president too, because she isn't there. Doesn't she go to the insurrection? That's what I
think. That's in the trailer. We haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, okay.
But they keep alluding to it in the early episodes of this season. Like what happened when Bradley Jackson, played by Reese Witherspoon, covered the incident at the Capitol.
That is a good teaser.
Yeah.
I definitely want to know where Reese Witherspoon was on January 6th.
Exactly.
I would like to know that.
And John Hamm has joined the show this year, too.
Yes, he's playing the billionaire in a way that is, I mean, yes, John Hamm wouldn't really have done this, but like, he's not doing a like ridiculous Elon or Richard Branson impression. He's playing it a little more suave, a little cooler, a little more of a decent person, which is
very unrealistic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Strains credulity.
But, you know, he joins a cast that is all really talented. We spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about Karen Pittman. Mm-hmm. Not enough time, though, because her character on Just Like That wasn't as big as
we
hoped.
Because she was too busy sending Reese Witherspoon to space. Yeah.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of time.
So we've got her. We've got Nestor Carbonell. We've got Billy Crudup and Mark Duplass and all manner of other people. Nicole Beharie joins this season.
Greta
Lee is great as a kind of executive who's in charge of kind of putting out PR fires. So anyway, it's a really fun, engaging show, and I'm glad that we were able to get this interview.
Yeah, our Vanity Fair colleague, Savannah Walsh, got a chance to chat with morning show executive producer Michael Ellenberg. She also spoke with consulting producer Brian Stelter, a Vanity Fair contributor who also hosts our podcast Inside the Hive, which covers media, politics, and many of the themes in the morning show. Check it out.
And just so you know, this interview was done following the guidelines of the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on Still Watching, Michael and Brian. I appreciate it, and I'm excited to talk about the show with you both. I want to start off, the second season was delayed by and made about the early days of the pandemic. Season 3 jumps forward past any sort of shutdown. Why do the time jump, and what did it feel like returning to the series during a relatively more sane time?
I'll do the second part first, which is much better returning during to make things during a relatively sane time. The show has often had a degree of clairvoyance to it, both from pitch to writing and then filming season one. Me Too happened after we sold the show, right? Season two, the pandemic interrupted us literally. We had to go re-break. So it was a relief while we explored many topical, noisy, complex events. None of them happened in real time. I shouldn't say that. Some of them did unfold and accelerate in real time over the course of the season, but none that required us to stop what we were doing and go back to the drawing board. In terms of the time jump, I think what we learned from season one from season one to season two, we want to follow a similar trajectory, which is the morning show wants to, we want to be able to locate our story and characters in a moment of time that's as ripe as possible. We want to be in dialogue with what's happening in the world right now. Our cast love it. I think the audience loves it. So staying, sort of beat by beat out of, and being through the details of COVID, the sort of point of season two was to land an idea around what were we all so busy with that we couldn't pay attention to this slow-moving car crash that was COVID, right? And then end as it happened. And it was very intentional to sort of pick up where we are now, what's changed, what's different, and then look at the media landscape as it is right now, which is certainly evolving, as your world would say. And the speed of its evolution has obviously been enhancing. So we just felt the moment in time we chose was really ripe to explore a range of themes, both politically, but frankly, first and foremost that would resonate the most with our characters.
It's actually insane how much the first four episodes cover in terms of terrain. There's space travel, the arrival of this billionaire tech mogul, reproductive rights, a data leak. Was there a storyline in there that felt the most daunting to tackle?
I don't think we can single out just one, but I loved how the space launch in episode one came on screen. Like I love the way it came alive on screen, because when Charlotte Stout, who is this incredible producer, the showrunner now for season three and beyond, as Charlotte came in and talked about where can we take these characters, what can happen in this post-pandemic emergency world, And we talked about Michael Strahan going into space live on Good Morning America, you know, to promote one of, I can't even remember which of the many rocket companies at this point, you know, that Strahan went on. But the point was, that is morning television. That is the drama and excess and excitement and story and emotion of morning television. And of course, you know, on the morning show, we do it in a different way, but using that as a little bit of inspiration, you know, talking to Charlotte and the writers about how that happened in real life, and then to actually see it brought to life with the characters. I just, you know, to me, it was better than the real thing. Like, you know what I mean, Savannah? It was better than the version that happened on live TV, because you feel like you're more a part of it. You could feel like you were actually there. And then at the end of episode one, to have Jennifer Aniston's character looking up and having Alex process, you know, this technical difficulty. I just love the way that came alive, because that felt daunting. They're setting that in the middle of, you know, West Texas.
Brian, you broke up at the very well timed, almost as though you were doing a bit,
because that is
when the signal broke up in the show itself.
Whoops. Just to end the episode on Alex Levy looking up at the television, wondering if her former co-host has died. You know, there was just so much there. And, you know, talk about daunting, you know, having that production out in the middle of the desert, et cetera, et cetera. So that's certainly top of my list. And I would just say, you think about in this season, you have references to the war in Ukraine, you know, the storyline about the war, you know, there are soldiers digging trenches like it's World War II. At the same time, you have these billionaires launching into space. There's a lot there about the injustices and inequalities and craziness of our real world that I think this show is mirroring and amplifying.
I'll add one more to that. The top of episode four, which, you know, speaking of things that are changing, like up fronts, right? So that may sound boring to our podcast listenership out there, but they were and kind of still are, while they're alive, these amazing spectacles in New York, these road shows that the networks performed for decades, really, for advertisers. And they were boozy boondoggles to make every program look like it's going to be the biggest hit of all time, even though the network always ended up canceling at least half, if not more, of the things they presented and sold. And we had to do all that New York giant theater and spectacle in a day, basically. So we had a pretty dazzling one take of Corey taking in his entire empire, almost all of our superstar cast, and it is a dazzling sequence that I think is really special. I think people will really enjoy.
Yeah, it was so wonderful to see Corey's like panned jokes that he's been written to tell, and just the whole performance of that was so fun to see.
Thanks, Greta. Secretly, I've been dreading this. Thanks, Greta. Secretly. I've been secretly dreading this.
Reenacted, especially in a year where we're not getting up fronts in the traditional sense.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's something I wanted to ask about, too. I feel like each time that the morning show comes out with a new season, there's sort of this debate over, some people are drawn in by how timely it is. Other people are like, it's not timely enough, or they have a hard time watching it because we just lived through whatever is being depicted. Where do you all fall on that? Obviously, you make the show, but how do you engage with that conversation when it comes around?
I think that tug of war, that back and forth, that is what's happening in the industry for real every day. Different people taking different positions on what is happening to television, where the industry is going, you know, whether they take a more pessimistic view or a more optimistic view, whether they see more destruction or more creativity and more new life in the industry. You know, and we hear that in these episodes talking about UBA Plus. You know, I think there's a reference in episode four about like the incredible shrinking network. A lot of people at networks feel like they're a part of an incredible shrinking network. Well, then isn't the challenge to figure out how to be a part of the solution to that, how to be a part of the resistance to that? And I got to admit, like, I get pretty inspired sometimes by the dialogue that Charlotte and the writers have come up with to portray where the industry might be going and where we all might find ourselves being.
Yeah, I think part of the way we think about it, Savannah, is an issue truly resolved or not, right? I think, because we, you know, what you try to do as a producer is put, obviously, the most, to the greatest extent possible, put yourself in the eyes of the audience, right? Which is, you want something that's juicy and electric and brings you into a moment in time that you could see anew. But I think also if there's, if, you know, we try to avoid having neat and tidy things to say. And, you know, so to the degree, you know, these are live issues, what Brian just spoke about, the state of both broadcast media, cable media, all of it, right? It couldn't be more in flux. There is no resolution to our, you know, to the political tensions in America right now. Roe v. Wade remains hotly contested, as is Dobbs. You know, most of the big social issues we tackle are just part of what we're all talking about, you know? And if you're going to capture also the texture of this world, that's what the characters inherently are dealing with, right? And so what we do, I think, in quite intentionally want to avoid is we're not trying to be soothsayers, right? So things often do happen that we talk about in real life. And sometimes you think you're so brilliant, and then, you know, Elon Musk bought Twitter while the thing was happening, right? Like, you were like, so sometimes you're so smart, you're not smart enough, right? Which is, that was happening in, like, we were, had started, I can't remember, we were either just, but we were filming already. And so you're like, okay, at least we're on topic, you know? You know, but whereas, but we don't want to either have, you know, sort of this, or we want to be able to touch enough of reality so you're never like, oh, they're just guessing at some fake future, or they're giving us a tidy moral lesson from the past.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. I think the introduction of Paul Marx, our tech billionaire, who is potentially going to be involved with UBA's future, speaks to that a lot. A lot of people have noted similarities to real-life billionaires that the character has, from the mention of Sun Valley to what some have noted as a very phallic-looking rocket. who helped inspire that character, and why was John Hamm the only choice to play it?
The inspiration is kind of, is these people exist. Obviously, there's the tech version, you know, so which is, you know, living in Los Angeles, anyone working in media today, the not just the influence, but right, but the invasion of tech to our world has been massive and just well documented. So that felt right. But we're also in the era of, yeah, the billionaire entrepreneur that believes they can innovate in not only in their home area of expertise, but they can do everything else better too. And so as a subject, I actually think there's almost too many people to choose from in terms of influence. And then Hamm, John, obviously, first and foremost, a great actor, but we were interested in the Mad Men stuff, you know? So, you know, he presents, he knows how his, John's charming, obviously incredibly handsome kind of embodiment of a certain kind of American industry leader, right? At the same time, he's able to put a smile and make something feel presentable and acceptable that may be wildly insidious. And we wanted that. We wanted someone we were really drawn to. In a weird way, there's a relevance to the Carell with Mitch Kessler, which was, we wanted with Steve Carell, we wanted you, the audience, to feel he's the dad next door. He's the uncle they wish they had. He's maybe the rascal they had beer with. And so you could connect with him. And similarly here, we didn't want, there's been plenty of portrayals of, let's say, extreme and unrelatable tech people, and there's a lot of great depictions of them and many things we love and are inspired by, but we were quite intentional about we didn't want the show to get hung up on, let's say, the stylistic quirks of a lot of the people you'll meet in tech on television, and rather have someone very accessible, very compelling, and someone you'd want to say yes to, you know? And so John, you never quite know where he stands. And he's someone, yeah, you want to get in bed with, maybe literally and figuratively. And then, you know, he's an exceptional actor. And we wanted also, for the first time, Billy, obviously he goes toe-to-toe with all these great actors on the show, but we wanted Corey to finally have someone, he's always been five steps ahead of everyone in the show, by and large. And we were drawn to the idea of having someone, maybe for the first time, he's a couple of clicks behind. Mm-hmm. And who could really be formidable, kind of in stature and in presence. And so John and Billy, they know each other a bit. That dynamic was as important to us as Paul's dynamic with Alex. And so, that's a lot actually on why he was great, but really John embodied those traits in a way almost no other actor could.
it's important for the world of the morning show, right, to have Hyperion exist and to have Paul Marx and to have to wrestle with this and have to think about where is the power? Where is the power now? There was a piece about Walter Isaacson's Elon Musk book by Sean McCreesh the other day in New York Mag that said there was a world decades ago of magazine editors and TV anchors, and, you know, there were emperors in that room. But that room is gone now. And now the new room is Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and Tim Cook. You know, and that is a dilemma that, you know, is faced by the morning show and faced by the entire network. And, you know, it's why UBA Plus exists. You know, this entire takeover by tech drives the story. So it's obvious Paul Marx is a composite. He's not Elon. He's not any of these single billionaires. He's a composite. But it reflects something very real that's happening in the media industry.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment when we return more with the morning show's Brian Stelter and Michael Ellenberg. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Something I wanted to ask you about, Brian, is at the beginning of the season, Alex and Bradley are a united front, partially due to the fact that they both have grievances with the network that they work at. Alex wants more of a seat at the table. Bradley is resisting this request that she drop a story about abortion to remain impartial during the election. It often makes headlines when anchors don't align with each other when they're sparring. But do alliances like Alex and Bradley's at the beginning of the season work in negotiating power at a network?
I think they certainly do at times. There have been times in real morning show history where the ensemble was so united. It was united front. You could not divide them. You know, they were actually real life friends off camera. And in those moments, which are usually few and far between, the network has less power. The stars have more power. You know, it creates an interesting dynamic. More often, I would say, in this business, in television news, there is a lack of that alignment. Different want different things at different times, and that maybe gives the networks more power. But certainly, that in an alignment or out of alignment is important to mine and explore. Also, here in season three, to have, you know, to again widen the world, to have the evening news, to have Bradley anchoring the evening news, it just lets us see even more of this world and even more of the dynamics that are at play.
And as ever, there's been a lot of broadcast cable news drama since the last season of The Morning Show came out. There's the ouster of major figures at CNN, at Fox News, Good Morning America. How much does that, I don't want to say expendability, but just we've seen so many major figures leave in the last few seasons, which feels like something that could be happening on The Morning Show. How much of the show is reflective of that current media landscape?
A lot, and I think more so as it goes forward, right? I think that's, there's a strike, speaking of ever-changing landscape, so we don't really know what the next season will be, but, you know, in the first season, there was a great scene, in the pilot, between Corey and Chip, Mark Duplass and Billy Crudup's character, and Corey gives a big speech about this world's going to have to reinvent itself soon, or they're all going to be bought out by tech. And really, the speech was kind of like, are we at the end of something? And so this year, you're starting to see that reality come to bear, which is this kind of last bastion of stability and profitability in the broadcast television world. And the shows remain wildly important to them. Nonetheless, the edifice around them is literally collapsing. ABC is in play. I mean, that's obviously an unimaginable event. And I think one of the things we posited when the show began was that the morning shows might be the last man standing. You know, and we seem to be somewhat correct about that thus far. So yeah, I think it's the energy of are they still relevant? You know, I think it's going to become more and more a theme that we explore as the show goes on.
One of the things I feel like The Morning Show does so well is peel back the layers of toxicity that live within this workplace. You know, each time you feel like you've uncovered another layer, there's more underneath. A lot of that's exposed with the data hack that happens at the end of the second episode. Anything could be revealed with a leak like that, and it really opens up the show. How did you decide what dirt gets unearthed?
Right. Well, because you did some of the research on this. We were all looking... We're storytellers first, right? So whatever's juiciest is the answer, right?
Right.
But we love the idea in a world, you know, in a period of social change where people are looking for their work lives to reflect their personal values in a way that maybe they never really have before. We were particularly drawn to things like HR. In episode 3, the pay inequity really comes to bear. And so, you know, this show is so much about exploring the difference between the public face we have and our private selves, right? And so in essence, the hack is the ultimate version of this, which is the network has a public face, which is noble and uplifting and has learned the lessons of Me Too and racial inequity and internalized all these lessons. And then the hack is the inner truth that gets revealed. And I think it's a big question. We're all, you know, I think everyone in America is wondering, you know, how much has really changed in the last 3 or 4 years and how much is the same. Mm-hmm. I think the hack gets underneath something that we're all wondering about. And it's just absolute pandemonium, right? And what did your colleagues say about each other? What's the secret text? What's personal on your device? The amount people mess up and share personal comments about each other, right? On official form, in your email, in your text that your office might, you kind of know could see, but don't really care about. So it's kind of, you know, it's the death of privacy, and you'll see many pieces of it ripple through the season.
And we had already conceived of this, and, you know, the scenes had already been shot in large part before the Dominion filings in the Fox News lawsuit.
Oh, no.
But think about that from last spring.
Now the hack came again. I was about to say.
You know, in February and March, Dominion released all of those emails and text messages from inside Fox News, where very vividly, you see how people feel about each other. You see people insulting each other. You see the backstabbing happening in real time in these text messages and emails. You know, so a hack is one way, as we saw with Sony nearly a decade ago. A really devastating lawsuit is another way. But this happens. You know, mm-hmm. I know that, you know, firsthand that the Fox Dominion case has changed the way that I communicate with sources at Fox. They are terrified to text message now. I have to pick up the phone, mm-hmm. You know, and so there's a version of that all throughout media, I think, as a result of Sony, as a result of Dominion, et cetera, et cetera.
It's fascinating because, I mean, the most damning result of the hack within the show is discovering that Sybil, a UBA board member, sends a racist email about Chris, the morning show's newest anchor. Corey, the network president, discourages Chris from pursuing legal action by saying, we should do the news, not be the news. How often is a tactic like this still being deployed and silencing employees about workplace misconduct when something like this happens?
Obviously, we're not, I mean, I shouldn't say we. I am not a journalist. Brian is a journalist. But you can only speak from kind of anecdotal sense of what goes on in the workplace. And I'm not putting you on the spot, Savannah, about Vanity Fair. But our assumption is as present as ever, right? Which is you have, and maybe that's why we're drawn to the idea, and not just to be jerks. I mean, not just... Work is work, you know what I mean? And people are trying to balance what's appropriate to show up in public or not, right? So it's hard hearing Corey say those things, but there's a truth in it, right? There's a truth in it for Chris, and Chris really does have to reckon with, which is, and she reckons with that all season. How far do I want to take this? How much do I want this to define me? And how much do I want to just go forward, right? And there aren't easy answers to that, right? You know, we can say there are, but then there are the people who live it and go through it. So there's both the kind of corporate villainous aspect of it, which is finding ways to force things and keep them under the rug and keep them from coming to light. But there's the flip side for those who are in it, which is how much do they want to bear in it? And I think we're still as a society figuring that out. What's, you know, we want radical transparency it seems like we still would like a little privacy.
Right.
And what's the balance between them? I don't think we know really what we want yet. And the show, yeah, it was very interesting just living in kind of the tension and drama of that.
This has been such a great conversation. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, you know, the show obviously deals with such topical issues. It's already been greenlit for a fourth season. We're living in the strikes in Hollywood, the topic of streaming revenue. What are the chances that that'll be woven into the next season?
Charlotte Stout, you know, as per the strikes, right, you're talking to producers on the show right now, not to the writer of it. So hard to say what exactly will come. But as we've been discussing, the show wants to engage with what is most top of mind. God willing, by definition, I shouldn't say God willing, by definition, once we get back to work, it means the strikes are over. So we will be somewhat in the past.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, look, we are, it feels like we're in some endgame moment right now where the future players are cementing themselves. The legacy players are in a real moment of figuring out what their place is going to be going forward. And our morning show pillar former pillar of stability, now a pillar of instability, is inherently, you know, it's a world that will be in, can remain in the crosshairs of all of these challenges. So I'm sure we'll be picking up, if not in the middle of it in an experiential way, certainly the questions being asked and battled over right now for sure will be our season.
The only through line is the morning show part, meaning every day, 7 a.m. Eastern time, there's got to be something on the air for as long as we're going to have broadcast television, right, Ellenberg? For as long as we're going to have this medium, there's got to be a host in the chair to tell you what happened last night. And that is like the only thing we know for sure in this ever-evolving world.
The only constant is that there is no constant other than the morning show. Well, delving into the season has been so delicious in so many ways. I really appreciate both of your perspectives on it, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
That does it for this episode of Still Watching. Please, as ever, send us any questions, concerns, feelings of injustice to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Rylaz.
And you can find me at Christris.
That was like a lot of buildup.
Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say. Where can you find me?
And you can find me at Hillabuster with two R's. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party, or having family over, or even just cooking for yourself, when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency, we're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
From PRX.